it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Come on, let's get going now.
From KMOX Sports.
We're primed and ready.
All day, baby.
Man, let's go.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Live. Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Sports Open Line on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly. We've got a lot to get to later on in the show. We'll be talking to Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune. That'll be just after the 7 o'clock hour about his story on San Diego Padres, former St. Louis Cardinals manager Mike Schilt's retirement and some of the fallout from that. We're going to be talking a lot of St. Louis Billikens in this first hour, including in just moments with Stu Durando, mostly about men's and women's soccer, the latter of which has a monster game tonight in Atlantic 10 play. Plus, Earl Austin Jr. will join us to focus on men's basketball. We'll touch on the NFL as well with Patrick Doherty of NBC Sports. Stu Durando is with us first. He covers SLU for his terrific Stu on SLU Substack website. You can find him on Twitter at Stu Durando or go direct to his site at stuonslu.substack.com. Stu, thanks so much for making some time for us on a busy night.
Yeah, no problem, Nate. Thanks for having me.
The SLU women's soccer team, unsurprisingly, 6 wins from 6 in Atlantic 10 play. They've lost just 2 games and drawn 1 on the course of the entire regular season. Their only 2 losses on the road against Penn State and Iowa, 2 of the better teams in the Big Ten, and a draw, kind of a surprise, 0-0 at home against Illinois State in the final non-conference game of the year. But they have been perfect in the Atlantic 10, survived a few 2-1 scares, including one last Sunday against Duquesne. Tonight, though, they play fellow 6-0 Dayton in a game that very much could decide the Atlantic 10 championship. And, of course, that's a championship that the St. Louis women are very much used to winning.
Yeah, and in recent years, it's come down to them and Dayton. Dayton's kind of been chasing them for several years now, trying to catch them at the top of the standings. And year by year, they seem to get a little closer. They've played the ties the last 2 seasons, so this one figures to be close. It's not only for the top of the conference, but a win and a loss here could go a long way toward at large possibilities for the NCAA tournament. For these teams, SLU has yet to post, kind of a significant win, having lost Iowa and Penn State. So they could use kind of a quote unquote signature win, which this would be, to help their RPI, plus also put them in first place if they can take it.
This game will be getting underway in under an hour. 7 o'clock kickoff here at Herman Stadium in Midtown. Still time to get over there for St. Louis and Dayton women in a critical match at the top of the Atlantic 10 because it's the fourth to last game of the regular season as well. So not going to be a lot of time if there is a winner and a loser as opposed to a draw. Not going to be a lot of time for a potential loser of tonight's game to make that up because they would need help with the other team dropping at least 1 game and just 3 to play in the Atlantic 10. Stu, let's talk about the men who are also enjoying a really nice season. Number 20 in the country nationally. They are unbeaten at home, 7-2-4 overall on the season, and have played some good games against big name opponents. Exhibition draw against Notre Dame, a home win over SMU, a 1-goal loss on the road against Indiana, back to one of the top spots in college soccer this year. What have you seen from the men's team?
Yeah, they've kind of been the opposite schedule-wise of the women, where they've played a really strong schedule and they've got some good results. I think they've played five of the top 30 RPI teams. Like you pointed out, some of those results. So those have really helped their strength of schedule. They've had a lot of trouble scoring goals this year, so they've been locked up in a lot of really low scoring, even for soccer games, scoreless draws and so on and so forth. They don't have anyone who stands out offensively. They've just got a lot of guys across the board who are capable of scoring, and I think they're still waiting to see if they can break out. They haven't scored more than two this year. And, you know, again, this is a game for first place. Winner goes into first and has control. And they play less. They play two fewer games than the women in the conference. So this one takes on extra weight.
Stu Durando is with us talking some SLU men's and women's soccer. Let's transition to Billiken's basketball. You can follow Stu on Twitter, at Stu Durando. You can get him on Substack, stuonslu.substack.com, which I saw is up to number 11 among rising sports Substack. So congratulations, sir.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to watch the analytics. Actually, I was number 9 today. So I cracked the top 10 for the first time.
Even better. So, must be in part because of the traffic bump that you've gotten for reporting that the SLU men's basketball team beat Iowa 99-74 in a secret scrimmage last weekend at Shea Fitz Arena. And, of course, that's first-year head coach Ben McCollum at Iowa coming off his season at Drake, where he had a lot of success with the Bulldogs, won the Missouri Valley, took them to the second round of the NCAA tournament after beating Missouri. You've been very firm that you've got the score exactly right. That is, if they played anywhere close to a normal basketball game, as opposed to teams really rotating a lot, and it seems like they did, that's a pretty significant score for St. Louis, even considering Iowa is in potentially a bit of a transitional year.
Yeah, I mean, from what Josh Church would talk about, it sounds like it was two different halves, very close and a little bit sloppy in the first half, but SLU put things together in the second half, especially in the third quarter, and it started making shots. And he described their defense as having been just consistent throughout the whole game, and that, I think, sounded like it was the highlight. They want to be really disruptive with their pressure this year and, you know, use some full court press, that kind of thing. And it sounds like it was probably pretty effective. I did not see any of it. I haven't seen video or anything along those lines, but it sounds like it was really effective against Iowa. And anytime you beat a Big Ten team, you know, secret scrimmage, a public scrimmage or whatever the heck it is, you know, it can't hurt. People get a little bit crazy about these secret scrimmages and try and make more of them than there is, but you'd rather be on the right side of a 25-point game than the wrong side.
St. Louis is going to play a ton of home games. In fact, only one true road game in the non-conference, only one true road game up until the turn of the year. And it's not, I'm not going to say it's a poor non-conference schedule, but it's not one that is loaded with big-name opponents. Do you think that was intentional from Josh Schertz, bearing in mind that the Billikens got off to that kind of up-and-down start last year, to try to give this team a little bit more runway early in the year to get themselves settled?
No. I think they would have liked it to have been a little bit stronger. Originally, Iowa, going back to, you know, last season, was on the schedule for a neutral game in Des Moines, and that got scratched. And then they had some problems with the scheduling at the their MTE in Palm Springs this year, where apparently the tournament organizers didn't give them the games that they signed a contract to get, or put them in a pod that they were supposed to be in. That affected a home game. So they would have liked a little bit more difficulty. It definitely is not a great non-conference schedule. It's probably weaker than last season's. You know, you have to wait and see how these other teams do throughout the course of the year. But as it looks right now, you know, they have the opportunity and the need to collect a ton of wins in non-conference.
Stu Durando, we appreciate your time, especially when you've got other things to cover this evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You can follow Stu on Twitter, at Stu Durando. You can subscribe to his Substack, stuonslu.substack.com. Talking more Billikens coming up after this, men's basketball, with our own KMOX radio analyst Earl Austin Jr., who you hear on every game with Bob Ramsey. They will be on the call in just a few weeks when the Billikens open up the season at Shea Fitz Arena Monday night, November 3rd, against Southeast Missouri. And you will hear him in minutes here as we continue Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Graybar Sports Open Line continues on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. We're talking St. Louis Billikens in the early part of this first hour. We'll have NFL and some college football coming up later on. In the second hour, we'll talk Cardinals. We'll visit with Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune about his story on Mike Schilt and the end of his time as manager of the San Diego Padres. And we will also discuss, as we did a little bit during Rush Hour Sports with Kevin Wheeler, the interest that obviously Albert Pujols has in managing. He's been interviewing with big league teams reportedly, but also the stated interest that Yadier Molina has in managing or coaching that he mentioned in an Instagram post. We'll continue those conversations, get in a little bit of chat about St. Louis City as well, maybe at the end, because we'll have Jen Cease coming in for City Spotlight right after this from 8 to 9 as they gear up for their final game of the season this weekend. Right now, though, we have Earl Austin Jr., who is the radio analyst right here on KMOX for St. Louis men's basketball alongside Bob Ramsey. Been doing those games together for a long time. Earl, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Nate, for having me. How are you?
I'm good. We just talked to Stu Durando a little bit about the men's basketball situation. We didn't get deep into it, certainly not into the roster, which you and I are going to talk about. But first of all, we did touch on the schedule and how home heavy it is, that it's frankly not as strong as they probably would have preferred. And so I would think, Earl, that that puts a lot of pressure. Well, I guess you could look at it two ways. You could say it puts a lot of pressure on them to be very, very good out of the gate because they're going to need a ton of wins and not very many losses in non-conference if they want to preserve an at-large possibility in the NCAA tournament. The other way you could look at it is the NCAA tournament at-large chances are already low enough that perhaps they just look at the non-conference as a tune-up and ultimately A-10 play is going to decide things.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens and see. I think I look for our conference to be a little bit stronger this year with us, VCU, Dayton, George Mason, GW, and Loyola should all be good. So what can enhance the at-large chances of the A-10 is obviously strong performances in the non-conference. And obviously, we got some opportunities. I think obviously you would like to get the, you know, you play Santa Clara and the Grand Canyon. Those are two teams that defeated us last year, and we have Grand Canyon on the home and home at home, and Santa Clara is in Palm Springs, and then you either have like Utah or Minnesota up in Palm Springs. So those are opportunities that you got to take advantage of, and hopefully you put together a strong non-conference record headed into the conference season. I think if you have a strong conference season, you hopefully it doesn't come down to winning the tournament.
Obviously, everybody's familiar with Robbie Avila in the middle for St. Louis, and he's back on the team. I think Billikens fans got familiar with Kalu Anya and with Dylan Warlick last year as the season goes on. But obviously, there is a lot of turnover on this year's roster. Who are the kind of two or three names that you're most excited to see and how they fit into Josh Schertz's plans?
Sure. Also returning is Kellen Thames from last year, who was really playing well last year until he had to leave the lineup with injuries and everything. And that really hurt us when he got hurt down at Illinois State. So he's back. He's probably our best athlete on the team. But, oh, there's so many of them, but just a couple of them. Amari Akatri as well is back, too. He really closed the year strong. He had 20 points and 10 rebounds in our last game against Arkansas State, a 6'6 sophomore guard from Milwaukee, I think, who's really on the upswing as well. As far as newcomers, out of the portal, we got six kids, but probably Quentin Jones is one guy you could really look at. He's a 6'5, kind of a point guard, point. It could be a combo guard from Northern Illinois. He kind of could score, but he can also set up teammates, has a nice outside jump shot inside to help Robbie. We got Paulo Tiono, who played at Kenya Pack last year. He's about 6'9", 240. He's a big physical power forward, but he can block shots. He can shoot it a little bit. Good scorer. And then one guy, just two other guys up there, Deion Brown, a 6'4 guard from Boston College. He's kind of a junkyard dog. He's going to be one of our leading rebounders. Tough, really can defend. And Brady Dunlap, a 6'7, 6'8 forward out of St. John's, who will be one of our better shooters on a team that has a lot of good outside shooting this year. Brody can really fill it up when he's really going.
We're visiting with Earl Austin Jr., our St. Louis Billikens men's basketball analyst here on KMOX. You mentioned Kellen Thames, and I'm glad you did, because I think when he was at his best a couple of years ago, a lot of people felt like we were looking at a future All-A-10 guard and one who maybe could have been ready to be that guy as soon as last year. Obviously, he's had his medical issues. There were real concerns about how much, if at all, he was going to be able to get back on the court. What's the outlook from what you've heard right now on how much he's going to be able to go?
All I can go up what I've seen in practice, and look like he's been going strong. He's been attacking the basket like he does. He's a great athlete. He's going to be one of our better defenders. And, you know, he's a decent outside shooter, but he gives you just that pop. You know, he could play guard multiple positions. And I think he's ready to go. I think what's the thing is he wouldn't be counted on for heavy minutes, because I think one thing we've improved upon this year is the depth of this team. Getting to an 8-man rotation is going to be a challenge, because we've got about 10, 11 guys who are capable of being contributors at this level, at the A-10 level, which is a good problem to have. And obviously, he's one of those guys as well. So I'm just happy to have him back. And he's looking strong and looking healthy. And hopefully that continues throughout the whole season.
It's a good point you make. In some ways, kind of a perfect storm last year with him having the issues that he did, but also how thin the top of that roster was, that in theory they would have loved to have him play such major minutes. Nice to be able to take a little bit of that off of him. Kind of in contrasting or talking about year two in the context of year one, one of the takeaways I think from year one for Josh Schertz was that this is a very complex system that he runs on the offensive end, and you could tell based on some of the up and down results early in the year that it took time for guys to get settled into that system, get fully comfortable, gel with one another within it. Part of that was maybe that he didn't have the depth he would have loved. Kellen Thames was in and out. You know, it was just a sort of up and down start to the year in a lot of ways. On the one hand, now it's year two. There's been more time for guys to get settled in. On the other hand, in the modern game, as you know as well as anybody, there's so much turnover on everybody's roster from year to year. How confident are you that Josh Schertz's system is going to be one that is teachable enough that the Billikens are going to be able to get off to better starts, even if the roster has that kind of significant turnover year over year, just every year annually?
Yeah, I think the one big thing that kind of was a big adjustment was that Robbie got hurt at the beginning of the year, and he missed a lot of time, and he missed a lot of the preseason practice, and then he got hurt again in our first game in South Dakota when we played Santa Clara. So he missed a good chunk of the non-conference, so we kind of had to mix and match. And when he came back, and then we lost Kellen, and Larry left and everything. I think this year, that's one of the real things, having a lot of depth, I think really has helped. And I think he really recruited a bigger team, a lot more depth and a lot more size. And one thing he really likes, obviously, outside shooting. He's a guy that really, us teams really rely on the three-point shot. And I think he recruited a lot of young men who really are fit for that system. One young man I didn't mention earlier was Trey Green, a young man from Xavier, a 6-foot guard who kind of reminds people of Isaiah Swope, another outstanding small guard who just graduated last year. He can really shoot it from long distance as well. So, like I said, just like any other team that's bringing in a lot of new faces, obviously we got four or five new freshmen getting some team chemistry while also trying to find a good rotation. It's going to be a work in progress throughout the non-conference season. And so hopefully by the beginning of the season and conference season, that's when you hope to be really rolling and have things. But this will be a continual work in progress. But one thing you really did a nice job is the personnel-wise is really strong. So if you have a early season injury here or there, you got people in place who can step in and really keep things rolling without a lot of drop off. And that kind of hurt last year when we lost guys.
Only 2.5 weeks from the opener, Monday night, November 3rd at Chaffetz Arena against Southeast Missouri. Next week, a week from tonight, we'll play an exhibition on the road against Bradley and Peoria. But the regular season will tip off for real in 2.5 weeks. Obviously, this is the time of year everybody wants to be positive, and there are a lot of reasons to be positive. But Earl, if I could trouble you for one, maybe not negative, but one concern. At this point, going into the season, if you had to pick out, this is the thing I'm most worried about, or I most want to see them do to assuage my concern, what would that area be?
Healthy. Good Lord, as a Billiken fan, we've seen Javonte Perkins tear his ACL in a preseason game against Rockhurst. Kind of had a decent 22 season, but it really changed the course of our season. Last year, Robbie Avila gets hurt in the public scrimmage. Then he's in and out of the lineup. Lewis Kellen, and I can go on and on. Fred Thatch tears an ACL his senior year. So that's the main thing. You just want to. Then, of course, we've had a couple guys nicked already. Dion dealing with a knee, but I think he's back in. I just want to have a good, healthy season. I think then I think you get a chance to see us be the best version of ourselves. And if that team does that, then there's a lot to be excited about, no question.
Well, Earl, we appreciate your time as always. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you plenty more, and certainly we'll be hearing from you 30-odd times once we get to November 3rd. Thanks a lot.
Hey, that's my pleasure. You take it easy now, Nate.
Earl Austin Jr., our analyst on KMOX for St. Louis Billikens men's basketball, joining us this evening on Gray Bar Sports Open Line. Patrick Doherty will be with us next, NFL writer for NBC Sports, and we'll be getting plenty into the Cardinals and Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols and their managerial aspirations. All of that to come in the second hour as well. Stay with us on 104.1 FM KMOX.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Gray Bar Sports Open Line this evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. So glad to have you with us. 104.1 FM, 1120 AM KMOX, or joining us on our streams on YouTube, on Twitter, on anywhere else, StreamYard, wherever you're getting us. We're happy to have you with us. You can participate by sending in your questions. You can also call us, of course, or use the TalkBack feature on the free Odyssey app. We've already talked some St. Louis Billikens with Stu Durando and with Earl Austin Jr. We're going to transition, talk a little bit of NFL with Pat Doherty, who is an NBC sports writer covering the NFL. You can follow him at RotoPat. We appreciate you being with us, sir.
My pleasure to be here. And I tell you what, I have some work to do tonight, but I should maybe stick around, I think, and listen to Kevin Acey dish on Mike Schilt. Very interested in what he's got to say there.
It is some dishing. We Kevin and I did that interview about 2 hours ago now, because he was busy this evening, or I guess it's still kind of afternoon for him out in San Diego. And you can imagine he probably has a lot of commitments right now, because that story has gotten a lot of interest, and understandably so. He said he worked on it for over a year in total, from the beginning to end, and it shows. It's awfully comprehensive. And so, yeah, if you can make a little time during those last few minutes before Thursday Night Football this evening, I think it's well worth everybody's time. Let's talk about Thursday Night Football first of all, since that's what will be coming up top of everybody's minds. And let's talk about the Cincinnati Bengals, because they're regional-ish here to St. Louis, about 5 hours or so drive east, and a team that would have had significant aspirations coming into the year. Obviously, losing a quarterback the caliber of Joe Burrow is always dramatic. On top of that, I think Jake Browning, I mean, this would be your area of expertise, but Jake Browning played a bit worse than he has in relief of Burrow in the past. The offensive line has been terrible. Just there hasn't been a lot to like. They did play a little bit better at Lambeau last weekend. Is there a path, do you think, for Cincinnati to relevance when Joe Burrow returns, or is this just going to be a lost season?
Maybe the one path is that the AFC North, we're used to it being one of the fiercest divisions in football, and it's just down this year. You know, the Bengals are really disappointing, 2-4. That's not as disappointing as the Ravens at 1-5. And, you know, the Steelers are winning the division right now, but it's kind of classic Mike Tomlin ball. It's kind of classic late period Aaron Rodgers football where they're not scoring a ton of points. They're basically trying to get to the end of 60 minutes, kind of a classic like play not to lose team. So it's a wide open division, especially by AFC North standards. But the Bengals were one of those teams where they didn't really have any margin for error. You know, last year, every game they played was a 60-minute shootout. They were lucky to get to, I believe, 9-8. And they needed like everything to go right in offense to even get to 9-8. They had not many injuries to their important skill players. Burrow stayed healthy all season, and they kind of needed a similar recipe this year. And so they couldn't have anything go wrong, and then they had the worst thing go wrong. The quarterback gets hurt. The timeline, I think, is just too long. He's not coming back until after Thanksgiving. I think Flacco was brought in to just kind of just improve the vibes. I don't know how else to say it. Like, he's a marginal upgrade over Jake Browning, but I think he can do a better job of playing pitch and catch with Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. But I think that's really just about kind of almost preventing boredom from the players, from the fans, and that it would take a miracle is a strong word, but it's not the most likely outcome that the Cincinnati Bengals make a run.
Let's talk about the Kansas City Chiefs, the you know, a little bit closer, about what, 4 hours, 3.5 hours drive west of here, and a frequent team played on these airwaves with Campbell Wex being part of the Chiefs radio network. Got off to that rocky start 0-2. They've since stabilized. Had the loss in Jacksonville last Monday night, but responded really well Sunday night with a 13-point win over Detroit. How do you evaluate a Kansas City team that is, on the one hand, probably disappointed to be 3-3, on the other hand, showed Sunday night, if nothing else, that they are still one of the forces in this league?
You know, the Chiefs just kind of a bizarre team in that they're 3-3 after 15-2 last year, and I frankly think it's probably a better overall team than they had last year. But you know, people who listen to the Chiefs every week know they were kind of running unsustainably hot, and kind of, I don't know what else to call it other than those luck categories. And of course, the better you are, the more luck you make for yourself. But the Chiefs were not going to continue to win every one-score game in existence. You know, they had won double-digit one-score games in a row, and that just does not happen. And they've had like a little regression to the mean in that department this year, where this, like that Jaguars game or the crazy ending, that's the kind of game the Chiefs would have won last year. Just bad luck that they're on the bad end of that this year. But to me, they look really loaded, like stocked up for a stretch run. You know, they're getting Rashee Rice back. They've been passing better. I think 1-53 is probably a better roster than they had last year. It is a really, really tough division. Like 11-6 is probably a good outcome for the Chiefs this year, but 11-6 could be the 2 or 3 seed in the AFC this year. No one really running away with it, and very disappointing start. I think we'll get a good ending for the Chiefs, and I mean, they're still a Super Bowl favorite even after 3-3. I think Chiefs fans can feel good about their chances down the stretch.
Patrick Doherty, NFL writer for NBC Sports, is with us this evening on Campbell X. You can follow him at RotoPat. You kind of stole my thunder on where I was going next, which is to try to make sense of what's going on at the top of the NFL and pick out favorites. So you're thinking you would still have to consider the Chiefs your favorite to win the Super Bowl. The two best records in the NFL right now belong to Tampa Bay and Indianapolis, both 5-1 in the NFC and AFC respectively. I don't think a lot of folks are picking a Buccaneers-Colts Super Bowl. So with the kind of mess that we have, I guess, among all these teams at 3-3, 4-2 that feel pretty good about themselves, how do you sort it all out and say, okay, the Chiefs, and then who are your other 2, 3, 4, 5 teams who you think are legitimate contenders at this stage?
I mean, the Eagles and the Bills are, of course, still going to be right there, but they almost seem to be in a little bit of like that malaise the Chiefs had the past 2 years. I say malaise. The Chiefs made the Super Bowl both those years. They won one of them, but they were just really grinding out games. You know, teams known for explosive offenses. The Chiefs, you know, the fans got tired of seeing like that station-to-station football. They're trying to open it back up this year, but you see the same thing that's kind of happening to the Bills, where the Bills have another very similar problem the Chiefs had, where the receivers got too expensive. They had to get rid of Stephon Diggs. They kind of tried to money ball the replacements, and it just hasn't worked out yet with the free agent bargains they tried to find, with the early draft picks they used on Keon Coleman, tight end Dalton Kincaid, and they just haven't had anyone step into that Stephon Diggs void where they're just a little more of a slog going down the field. It's the same thing with the Eagles. And they're both still fine on defense. The Eagles have kind of come back to the pack a little bit on defense. But the teams have come back to the pack just because we're used to them being able to outscore anybody, or at the very least, like, make more explosive plays than anyone else. And they've kind of come back to just where the Chiefs are, where every game is going to be close. It's a 60-minute game, and yeah, I don't know. It's just a really weird year where the team, like early in the season, the Packers look like they might be a force to be reckoned with, but they've had several disappointing games in a row. The Colts, you know, can you really bet on Daniel Jones? The Bucks do strike me as a legitimate dark horse contender, but they're just ravaged by injury. And yeah, it's still only early October, mid October now, but this is maybe as late in the year as I've ever gone without seeing a team that to me is a clear favorite, which is kind of why I'm just defaulting back to Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Like, when in doubt, pick the Kansas City Chiefs to make the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that feels like we could just clip that sentence from the end, and that could be considered the expert analysis. Because, I mean, where else are you really supposed to go? It has been messy. It has been a little bit chaotic. It's a little hard to sort through of it all. And so maybe defaulting back to the Chiefs is not the worst thing in the world. Patrick Daugherty with us this evening on Sports Open Line. Thanks so much for your time. Enjoy the game tonight.
Always my pleasure to come on KMOX anytime.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you. Patrick Daugherty at RotoPat on social media, NFL writer for NBC Sports. We'll wrap up this hour when we return and look ahead to Cardinals baseball talk happening in the second hour with, as mentioned, with Patrick, Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune joining us just after the news at the top of the hour. All of that is coming up and more. Graybar Sports Open Line, the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Graybar Sports Open Line continues. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauley on this Thursday evening. Thank you so much for being with us. Wrapping up the first hour, we will be talking a lot of Cardinals in the second hour. If you haven't heard it, you probably have by now. We've been mentioning it, but we'll visit with Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union-Tribune, who wrote the story about Mike Schilt's departure from San Diego, retiring, his choice. Everybody's been very adamant about that, including on the Padres side. But sort of some of the reaction, I suppose you'd say, some insight into how his tenure went and his dealings with his coaching staffs, the support staff, kind of how he handled the front office, all of that. And certainly there are parallels, there are mentions of his time in St. Louis and how a lot of this stuff was comparable. We'll discuss that with Kevin, and then we'll talk just us after the fact as the second hour goes on about that. We'll also discuss Yadier Molina and Albert Pujols and their interest in managing in the major leagues, in Yadi's case, potentially coaching as well, until those managerial opportunities pop up. With Albert, it sounds like the managerial opportunities are going to be popping up without any need to serve as a bench coach or something similar before that. Before we do that, though, we should talk a little bit of college football, because the Missouri Tigers are coming off, in some ways, a very disappointing loss. Not the typical kind of disappointing loss. I feel like in a lot of big games, we've been saying that they just weren't quite there, right? That they weren't at the level that they need to be to compete with the elite teams. And I think it's fair, with the way they've recovered since Florida State in week one, to call Alabama one of the elite teams. Maybe you call them one of the 1B tier teams at this stage. Maybe you say that Ohio State, Miami, and Indiana have kind of separated themselves right now as being the top three over Alabama or anybody else. And I could buy that. I wouldn't be upset about that. But even then, you're talking about somebody that's in the 1B tier teams. Certainly one of the top teams, one of the top 10 teams in the country, without a doubt. Maybe one of the top five teams in the country. They've settled themselves. And Missouri played well in the game. They weren't perfect. There were still... What's frustrating is some of the repetition, you know, the Zion Young penalty in the first quarter. Just very undisciplined to take a personal foul after the play. That's something Missouri has done far too often in big games. Played like they were not as prepared, like they hadn't been there before. Like Alabama had been there before and Missouri hadn't. And I did feel some of that early in the game. But ultimately, Missouri acquitted themselves quite well. They showed that on talent, they could hang around. They showed that on execution, for the most part, they could hang around. It wasn't flawless, but it rarely is in a college football game. And but for Alabama making some big plays down the stretch, you know, turning a third and 25 into a first down, including on a fourth and eight, converting on a fourth down and goal on that last, or I guess it was second to last offensive possession for Alabama with the running out the clock possession at the end. Missouri could have easily gotten a stop on that drive, probably should have gotten a stop on that drive, and we might be talking about something very different. Bo Prabula could have easily picked a different receiver on the interception that effectively ended the game. You know, Marquise Johnson jumping up and down was open. That play was makeable. The frustration, I think, for Missouri is when those moments feel too similar to how past games have gone down. Overall, though, I felt like this was a real step forward, even if it feels like a missed opportunity for Missouri falling to 5-1 in a game they could have won that would have been massive to win. They'll have Auburn on the road, an Auburn program that is in kind of disarray right now with Hugh Freeze dismissing a team captain and a lot of folks, including players, questioning whether he was being totally truthful in the explanation that he gave. That line has moved a lot, maybe because of that. Auburn was favored coming into the week, and that is no longer the case. Missouri is going to be dealing with a difficult environment. Tonight game in what's become one of the more underrated stadiums in the SEC because Auburn hasn't been very good. That's going to be a big challenge. If they bounce back and win that game, everything is still on the table, even with tough games coming up. We'll talk a little bit more about Missouri maybe in the second hour as well where we have time. But it's Cardinals discussion next here on KMOX.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.